Well, good morning, everyone. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Charlene Shirk sitting in today for Melissa Ross. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, just ahead, we're going to have a conversation with Jacksonville City Councilwoman Brenda Priestley-Jackson. And the number to call in is 549-2937. We'll also speak with a talented poet and educator who just happens to be blind. Then later, a taste of the weekend. Should be a nice weekend, so you want to hear what's going on all around town. But first this hour, Brenda Priestley-Jackson, City Councilwoman for District 10. We're going to discuss her stance on the controversy surrounding the possible sale of JEA, the shelved half-penny sales tax to improve schools in Jacksonville, the economic opportunities and challenges that seem to plague and face the Northwest side, as well as take your calls and questions. We always want you to be a part of the conversation. Jacksonville City Councilwoman Brenda Priestley-Jackson joins us now to discuss all that and more. Good morning, Councilwoman.
Good morning. How are you?
Thank you for joining us. I know you are stuck in the infamous Jacksonville traffic, and so you've been so kind to join us by phone until you make it to the studio. So thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And again, the number to call is 549-2937. Councilwoman, I'd like to start with last night's city council meeting and the concern over JEA's estimated $338 million unfunded pension liability if that public utility is sold. It seems like there are multiple parts of this potential sale that seem to be coming under much controversy and scrutiny. And last night, City Councilman Matt Carlucci said he would file legislation Wednesday that would earmark monies from the minimum $3 billion in proceeds from a sale of JEA to pay for the utility's unfunded liability to ensure that that pension doesn't become a burden on the next generation of taxpayers. But that was something you have brought up in the past and that you actually wanted as part of the bidding process for the sale, but were told that the bidding terms were set and could not be altered. So can you walk us through a little bit what the difference between your request and what Councilman Carlucci is proposing?
Right. So I will share with you what my concerns were and are, and I'm not actually familiar with Councilman Carlucci's pending legislation, but my primary concern was something of this magnitude should involve the members of the Jacksonville City Council. We are elected to represent our neighbors in Jacksonville, Duval County. And so my opening question was, could we, and this was an inquiry to General Counsel, could the Jacksonville City Council by resolution or any other form of legislation require or request the JEA board, which is appointed, to amend the ITN to include not only the unfunded pension liability, but any other concerns that council members might have. I was narrowly focused on the unfunded pension liability because at the time there was pending legislation before the city council that said the city would be responsible for the pension liability in the event of a recapitalization event of JEA, which is the fancy way we call a sale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, we just got out of a whole pension controversy.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. So we're talking about several hundred million dollars of unfunded pension liability. Historically, JEA paid their share for their employees. And so that, to me, was not something that the city, and it had nothing to do with the assurances of the JEA employees. Many are our neighbors in Jacksonville, but it actually had to do with the quality of life for us in Jacksonville on a whole. And to have a debt in the future of possibly, you know, $500 million, it could easily be, if not more, on top of the pension that we've already extended the Better Jacksonville plan to address, I did not think that that was prudent or advisable. So that was the issue.
And that was your request, if you could put that into the bidding process. And you were told by the City Council President Scott Wilson that you basically couldn't do that.
No, that wasn't by the council president. That was by the Office of General Counsel.
The Office of General Counsel. So, which then leads me to my next question. What City Council President Scott Wilson did say that the council is ready to hire an independent counsel to start helping you vet through these potential bids that you get for the sale of JEA. Is this something that you'd want to take up with that independent counsel?
I think that I want to take up the full gamut of what's the role and responsibility of the city council. And so that's why my initial question to general counsel was, what's the role and interplay between the city council and the JEA board? Because to me, that determines the parameters of our relationship and where we can intervene and be involved. It's not favorable or it does not make me believe that we don't have a role in this decision making or in the discussion of it as elected council members until the item were to come back to us for action. That just doesn't seem to make sense to me. So I really want to know, based on our charter, based on the Constitution for the state of Florida and legal precedent, what's our role? And I'll tell you where my idea actually came from. My colleagues on the council were very adamant that they wanted to see the members of the school board amend their plan to consider certain factors, particularly for choice and charge and other issues. Surely, if we could require or request the school board to possibly amend their plan, I would think that an advisory board like JEA would be required to heed whatever the elected city council decided they wanted to have considered if it passes by a favorable resolution.
And Councilwoman, I also want to visit on kind of your concerns and motivations seem to be of a deeper, more philosophical platform, if you will, because you've painted a broader brush on the JEA sales and how it actually speaks to and impacts the theory of consolidation of the city itself. Can you share your thoughts a little bit? I don't know if everybody has had the opportunity to read a little bit about what you've written about your concerns and what you've said about your concerns about the correlation between the sale of JEA and consolidation in the city.
Right. So, our some of the founders of our modern government in Jacksonville made a decision about 50 years ago that we would have consolidated government. And so our charter was a product of the consolidated government. And there were several factors as to why that was decided. You know, we had pending criminal matters that were involved. We felt that there was a degree of inefficiency. Jacksonville was growing and expanding, so it wanted to offer better quality of services. So a part that came out of this was our municipally owned utility, JEA, along with other independent authorities. So if you think of JTA, Jacksport, some others, they came out of this. And the position was advanced that if this is municipally owned, right, then we can ensure a certain quality of life in Jacksonville based on the relationship between these independent agencies and city government. And so for us in Jacksonville, the quality of life involves, in some ways, high-quality services for our electric, water, and sewer. And remember, we promised certain deliverables in terms of sewer and other things mm-hmm. under consolidation. We haven't fully delivered on those. I think we've done maybe, 75 miles of the 200 miles that was proposed. And then also, we've been able to mitigate costs and ensure better quality services because we're municipally owned. And that relates to our federal reimbursements from the state, from the federal government and others for FEMA and other disaster relief. Those, we get those costs paid through grants and others entitlements from the state and federal government. If we have hurricanes or other weather events, most, if you are privately owned utility, that cost we pass on to the taxpayers. So my concern becomes not only costs passed on to ratepayers and businesses, but my concern also becomes the inability of some of our neighbors who are in more economically vulnerable positions to actually pay for those services. But it also relates to, will we create two Jacksonvilles, right? So if we said we wanted efficiency, high-quality services as one of the variables for our having consolidation, and we know that JEA has been more centered and focused on improving its services over the last several years, to retreat from that now for short-term gain and advantage on a short-term sale, short-term benefits from a sale, I think long-term down the road when, you know, we don't have rebates before us, when we realize the impact of not being municipally owned, when we see the perhaps diminution in the quality of services that are provided, then I think that becomes an erosion of our quality of life, but I also think it will make the other independent authorities and agencies have a look to see if, you know, being an independent agency or part of consolidation is to their benefit, too. That it was not a just purely financial decision in terms of the consolidation of the independent agencies. It was a quality of life. So we assure our neighbors in Jacksonville that we are going to maintain certain standards, and a part of those standards are maintained because of the municipal nature of the authority.
Did you happen to have the chance to read former Mayor Jake Gottbold's kind of editorial on the proposed sale of JEA over the weekend? It was quite the social media stir.
Yes, I did.
And what were your thoughts on his comments on that?
I think he gave a great historical analysis and made many valid points.
Councilwoman's now entered the studio, and she is adjusting to our microphone. We'll give you a second to go ahead and get adjusted. Yeah, it made quite the social. It was quite the hot sensation conversation. And Jake Gottbold has never been known to mince his words, if you will. So he certainly spoke, I think, from the heart, from his experience, and really just, you know, there's a new book about him as well, talking about how he seemed to be at times kind of the clear voice of the city at times.
Yeah, I think that he gave a great historical perspective on the benefits of having JEA as municipally owned, the whole theory that JEA is ours, and somewhat that we are trustees for future generations of ensuring that high quality asset that we all need and value and use is available. I want to be clear that I think that I don't know the actual valuation of JEA right now. I cannot say what it is. I know that you've heard different numbers bantered around, whether it was going to be $3 billion or, you know, some other figure. I will share with you that from my perspective, that's not a huge sum of money. When I was on the school board, we had about a $1.4, $1.5 billion budget every year. So that's like 2 years. And I am deeply troubled by the possibility that we get a short-term return. Folks get rebates, we take the pension liability, and then we find ourselves 5 years down the road with an erosion in our quality of life, poor services, folks in our community who cannot afford to have or pay their utility bills. Employment for those who work for JEA has been eroded with not the same level of benefits and all of that. And so, you know, you don't want to dismantle something that you've had for 50 years that a lot of folks put a lot of thought into. And so for me, it could become a slippery slope. So if we think that we can recapitalize JEA today, does that mean we're going to think we can recapitalize Jacksport tomorrow or JTA the next day? Or JEA the next day, or the housing authority. That's not what consolidation means. Consolidation says we're going to provide high quality services to Duval County, Jacksonville, Florida, which happens to be the largest city in the United States of America. And we're going to do it by making certain services are really somewhat centralized. That's what that independent agency concept or authority concept kind of means. And we're going to make certain that they ultimately, these agencies are accountable to residents, taxpayers, and our mechanism of doing that is by having them as an independent authority, their boards being appointed oftentimes by the mayor and others, but approved by city council with a voice in the process and the operations of that to make certain that it's something viable for 50 more years.
And I want to switch gears a little bit. I think we've covered the JEA, and I appreciate you advancing it and then also kind of revisiting the consolidation conversation, because I really feel it. We really haven't heard that part of the conversation. You've previously served on the school board. You are now watching the battle over that half-cent tax for schools play out. I want to ask your thoughts on that matter, too, because in reading a little bit about more about your background, again, and your philosophy, you really also look at this as a bigger issue other than schools that are in disrepair. You've actually kind of gone back to a time when schools were supposed to have been desegregated and were not, even decades after the law mandated it. And as a result of that, we are now in the situation that we are in. Can you share a little bit about that as well?
Right. So we had Brown 1 in 54 and Brown 2 in 56. And Duval County did not actually desegregate its schools with the mechanism being mandatory busing until 1971. And so what that actually means in practical from a practical sense, is we continue to build separate schools. We continue to build black schools and white schools for 17 years after Brown was decided. We were not in compliance with the Supreme Court decision, so we had a surplus in inventory. And so we still have that surplus in inventory today. So for me, that's not just a Duval County Public Schools issue. That's a Jacksonville issue, too, relative to consolidation and everything else. So if you look at some of these surplus schools or the schools that are in the greatest state of disrepair right now, they overlap with some of our most vulnerable communities, a lot of the communities that are in the African-American, majority African-American section of town. We also see those same communities that have not had the promises of consolidation with infrastructure taken care of. And so what you have is that if you have not properly invested in certain communities, you've built a surplus of schools in those communities because you didn't comply. Those folks who are in a better socioeconomic position have left, right? So once they left because they didn't want the diminution in services, they didn't want, you know, the schools are under capacity. And so that's a Jacksonville issue, because had we complied with Brown in 54 or 56, we would not have this surplus of schools or some of the oldest schools in the state. So my thoughts are that's Jacksonville. That needs to be a Jacksonville, Duval County, and Duval County Public Schools project together to decide what does world-class schools look like at this time. But it's a city obligation equal to the school district's obligation.
And so talk about what your stance was, if I'm remembering correctly. You're supporting wanting to put this in front of the voters. Then there was a hold on that, saying we don't really have maybe the checklist of schools that would be targeted. That came in at what some council members felt was the 11th hour. Then in a dramatic meeting and clearing of chambers, can you kind of recap what your thoughts were on that and then move us forward as to where we are now? And if folks want to have their voices heard, what do they do? How do they communicate? Because there's out in the public there, many people feel that the current city council board is not responding to their concerns. They're not listening to them.
Okay. So I'll start by saying that I think the decision to have the half-cent sales tax was properly before the purview of the Duval County School Board. And as a body politic, that was their decision to make and determine. And I probably see that uniquely because I served on that body about 8.5 years ago. That's a separate issue from what my colleagues on the council felt was their voice, similar to what I feel my voice is with JEA in terms of what should the facilities plan look like? What are the factors that should be considered? I don't think that, and I truly don't believe that my colleagues on the city council were not hearing the public, that they disregarded the public. But let's be clear what happened. We were elected and we were sworn in the 1st of July. The very first committee meetings we had 2 weeks later, this was the issue that was before us. So other than Tommy Hazuri, there's not another member on the city council right now that served on the school board. So at the very time that many of us are learning our roles and responsibilities as an elected city council member, you're forced to deal with something that involves the Duval County School Board. You don't know the separation of authority and power. My hope would have been that there would have been more coordination between the school board and the Jacksonville City Council in advance of all of this, that this would not have been presented in this manner. So you've got city council folk trying to understand not only city business, but also put in this position to determine whether or not a half cent sales tax should be put on the ballot by the school board. And so I think the issues got confused. So it was really the issue of the quality of the schools got overshadowed by the, I think, confusion.
Because it's a passionate issue. Yeah, we don't want children sitting in environments where they can't learn and they may not be safe. So you've got the passion on the other side. And then it sounds like, simply put, you all came in and said, let us take a moment and really look at what the decision is that we need to make here, because it has some serious repercussions.
Right. And so I voted in support of it because I supported the body. Did I think that the plan as articulated and put forward was thoughtful and included all that I would like to see? Probably not as Brenda, the layperson, but Brenda, the former member of the school board, is on the city council, understands I'm not elected to do that. They were. And so my hope now will be that we can move forward at some point to get it before the voters. They want to have a decision and a voice in it. I think that I'd like to see the Duval County School Board overlay whatever their plan is for facilities with student achievement. That was one of my, you know, my big pieces. And that was something that we traced every decision back to in my time on the school board. I'm hopeful that with doing that in some future conversations that we can get it before the voters and we can make a decision on it.
And let's talk a little bit about, and so when you say that, when do you think you'll try to get it before the voters?
There's nothing on our agenda right now. Mm-hmm. So whether or not.
Wasn't there a certain amount of time that if we say no now, it won't be able to become, we won't revisit this till X?
No, because it was withdrawn. So it wasn't voted down. So the one beauty in it being withdrawn is it can come back anytime. It can come back today. It can come back tomorrow.
And I think a lot of voters don't understand
that. It was withdrawn. The other challenge of it being withdrawn was means that it's not on the council's agenda. So some in the public feel you're not even looking at it. You're not entertaining it. My hope is that there will be conversations going on and something comes back before us, timely for us to act on.
Now, you mentioned the education being one of the things that you really stand behind, one of your most important issues, education and economy. Let's talk a little bit about your particular area, the District 10 that you're in. Remind folks who may not be familiar what kind of area that particularly covers, because I do want to talk a little bit about what you're able to do. These are one controversy. Let's talk about what you are focused on and the impact that you're trying to make in your community.
Okay, so District 10, it kind of snakes down 295. So it starts at US 1. That area on 295, and we take 295 south all the way to 103rd Street. And ironically enough, District 10 has 16 precincts. 8 are what I call the central region, which would be east of 295, and then 8 are what I call the southwest region, would be about 103rd Street. So it's a very diverse population. It's actually the largest of the minority access districts. There are 70,000 plus neighbors in District 10. What my hope is that we can address some of the education needs for our young people in District 10 and also those in the area who want to go back and retool their skills for better wages and jobs. And so I have had conversations with some of the local skilled unions and the first responders about possibly having an apprenticeship program embedded in Peterson. Peterson is in District 10. And so wouldn't it be amazing to see an apprenticeship program for electricians or machinists or JSO or Jacksonville Fire and Rescue that starts maybe in 11th grade and then the students.
Because that's when you lose so many kids.
Exactly. There's this illusion that they have time. So they don't think I can do what I do when I graduate a year or two from now. That's not so. And so if we can grab them then and have a seamless transition from high school to Jacksonville Community College for one of these, you know, they could get out, get working, get jobs and things like that. And I think that's the greatest intervention to deal with our crime and safety issue.
Because FSCJ, the downtown campus, specializes in things like aeronautic mechanics and culinary. And a lot of those fields, you're going to get a six-figure job. And I think that there is that misunderstanding when you get that. Or they just don't see the big picture. Right. The young people don't see the big picture. Let's take a caller. We have got Susan in Mandarin, and my first shot at the phones this morning. So let's see, do we do? Susan, are you here? Susan, are you there? Good morning, Susan.
I have two questions. The first one is, if the school board resubmits the referendum with a December election and a mail-in only ballot, do you think the city council would finally let us vote in 2019? It might save all the taxpayers some money for the attorneys and then the second question is, what do you think would have happened if Jason Gabriel had originally told the city council that shall means must rather than shall means may? And thanks so much for being on the show.
All right. Thank you, Susan.
Okay. So the first question, once an item comes back before me from the school board for the tax referendum, I'll vote for it. I can't say what my 18 colleagues are going to do. I will vote. I voted for it the first time. I'll vote for it again. And so my hope is that they will present something back to the city council as soon as possible. That's what I would hope for that. And so I think that they can ask. The logistics of a December vote mail by in, that would be in the purview of our supervisor of elections. I think anything is possible if there's a will for it. So that would be that. I also think that relative to, the shall means may or must, the discretion of shall that we've been talking about a lot. I think that there's so much fact-specific context for legal opinions. I say that as someone who's been practicing law for 24 years. Shall is pretty much not discretionary. It's mandatory. I think that the nuance of how the shall is placed in the sentence, which has been advanced by our Office of General Counsel, would harken back to my old English teacher days. And so we probably could debate all of that all day long. I don't think the shall or may issue is the only challenge we face. I think the challenge that we face is our general counsel is knowledgeable, and he is a UF law grad just like I am. You can't serve so many diverse masters. And that becomes the problem when you have the largest, one of the largest firms in Jacksonville offering legal advice to city council, the mayor, the school board, the independent agencies and authorities, because they're competing interests by very definition. And so that is why I think that probably we can look futuristically to any charter changes that may say what the appointment of general counsel may look like for the other independent authorities to maybe have a different kind of voice in that. Or maybe there'll be a decision made early on that general counsel will say that they will hire outside counsel for certain issues to begin with.
I want to grab a call from Tom. He's been on hold for a while. Tom, thanks so much for hanging in there. Go ahead for your question for City Councilwoman.
Yes, ma'am. I just want to say good morning to y'all and thank you. I'm really concerned at this point with the direction of our city government. On the JEA sale, I'm absolutely opposed to it. As for the schools, I am wanting that to get to the ballot as soon as possible so we can get these schools repaired and fully functional so that we can do the best we can for the students. My biggest concern is I have not heard anything further about any investigation into the activities of the fourth floor of City Hall regarding both the KHA grants, the Kids Hope Alliance grants, and also the consulting contracts to both the city and the school board. Is there any way that the city council can either compel or solicit further investigation into that? Because those instances are both troubling as to the honesty that we're seeing from the mayor's office. And it definitely, for the public good, needs to be investigated.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. I will share that. I think there are ongoing investigations relative to Kids Hope Alliance, and that might be with the city's inspector general. I'm not certain. And so we would naturally not receive any intermediate reports on that. Whenever the report is completed, that will come before city council. So that is the only thing that I am loosely aware that's out there. Other issues relative to consulting agreements or lack thereof, that's really not something that I have been involved in or engaged in or actually asked questions about. And let's be clear. We have a half cent sales tax. We need to improve our schools so our young people can be in high quality educational environments to learn. That's 130,000 students, right? And we have JEA, one of our most prized assets that we run the risk of having recapitalized, i.e. sold right now. So those are the big items for me that have kind of garnered my attention. These others that relate to the, you know, Kids Hope Alliance or consulting agreements, I'm not saying that they're not meritorious. I just would be very candid and say they're not front and center for me.
And let's talk about something else, though, that may be front and center for a lot of people in Jacksonville, and that's downtown and redevelopment. And I know that particularly your area, there's always a tendency to kind of overlook that area because everybody talks specifically just about downtown growth. But really, growth is growth when you're looking at the success of a city, the economic impact of a community. And there's a lot of concern over crime in our community. But I know that you've said in the past, look, if you don't have education right, you're not going to have economic development right. You're never going to solve the violence problem. So can you talk a little bit about, and I think when I mentioned to you that, you know, a lot of folks in Jacksonville feel that they're not being heard, the quote unquote lack of vision that many people feel is going on right now with the demolition of so many buildings, and the landing seems to be, in fact, Melissa, had a great interview in a group yesterday talking about that seems to be just kind of bringing everybody this issue to a head. Can you talk about what your thoughts are about the vision, lack of vision for downtown, but then also how it impacts your area?
Right. So I think we've got to try to have some shared vision of growth in Jacksonville just in general. Right. And so I don't know that we have done the proper amount of an information and education campaign for our neighbors in Jacksonville on the viability of a downtown. So I remember, I'm 52, I'll be 53 next month. So I remember when downtown was a hub, my first ride on the city bus was to go downtown to go shopping and do various things. My kids, who are 30 to 18, have no knowledge of a viable downtown like that. So I think part and parcel of investment in downtown is an education campaign on why you need to invest in downtown. I am very encouraged by some of the proposals for growth and development that are going to have affordable housing downtown. They're going to, it's going to look a little more like some other cosmopolitan or urban centers and cities. So I think that's a good thing. I don't want that investment done to the detriment of the outlying areas, particularly what the black suburbs. So District 10 is a black suburb, theoretically. That's the definition of District 10. We have growth. We have growth in District 10 because the joke is you don't have any place else to go.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In the outlying area, that's within a quick, you know, and there's also the transportation. That's a quick little bus ride or a quick little ride downtown where you have jobs, where you have viable places to shop, to eat, to have a lifestyle. Right. I think maybe that's what it is. There's no lifestyle that's associated with downtown.
Right. So I think that's the shared vision. So we want folks to have access to downtown, but we also want them to have the services that they need in the suburbs as well.
Before we run, Brent, I want to get Stanley on. He's been holding quite a bit. Stanley on the north side. He's from your area, and I want to make sure he gets his voice heard as well. Good morning, Stanley.
Good morning, ladies. I support Ms. Priestley Jackson, what she's been doing at the present time. The opportunity to see her on the fourth floor, and she's an asset to the city of Jacksonville. When it comes to changing downtown, you need some visionaries. You're having the same people because city government don't supposed to create downtown. It doesn't really supposed to create the city. It's supposed to govern the city, and I mean in constituents. And we do a very poor job for the last 60 years in Jacksonville, as far as I've been on this earth. And that's my main concern. And I think Ms. Jackson is going to be an asset that will help move this city closer together. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. And we've got to wrap, but do you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to share with folks?
I just want people to be involved. And so what the involvement looks like is there's a lot of fighting and bickering that's going on right now. And it's troubling to me because while, you know, the elephants are fighting, the grass is getting beaten, right? Who's the grass? Our everyday neighbors, everyday people, students, you know, the residents in Jacksonville relative to our city-owned utility. And so get in, reach out to your council member, reach out to your neighborhood association, make your voice heard, and let's decide as a community what we need addressed immediately in Jacksonville. But more importantly, what do we want to see in Jacksonville 5 to 10 years from now? Those who've been around for a while, I want to hear their voices in that particularly.
All right. Thank you so much, Councilwoman Brenda Priestley Jackson from District 10. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for the hustle this morning from the car into the studio.
Thank you.
Up next, blind poet and UNF professor Emily Michael will join us. We'll be right back.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. This season, we're celebrating the 250th birthday of perhaps the most transformative composer in all of music history, Ludwig van Beethoven. We're beginning our Masterworks season with his unique symphony, The Pastoral. Beethoven said, "No one can love the country as I do," and the beautiful Pastoral Symphony provides the proof. Join us October 4th and 5th. Tickets and more at jackssymphony.org.
This Week in This American Life, a story about doubt and three people who let those doubts spread and gain momentum and convince officials and convince a whole community. And finally, those doubts turn into a kind of fact. We're rerunning this investigation that we did with the Marshall Project and ProPublica that went on to win a Peabody Award and also a Pulitzer Prize, and now is the basis of the new Netflix series Unbelievable. That's this week.
Saturday at 1 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Now for only $9.90, unlock access to the world's best documentaries through WJCT's newest member benefit, PBS's Passport and Curiosity Stream combined. Visit WJCT.org/donate and begin streaming this incredible collection of documentaries today.
Welcome back, everyone. Emily Michael is a poet and a UNF English professor. She also just happens to be blind. She joins us now to share her story and what she's up to lately. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you have your canine companion. Can you introduce your canine companion?
Sure. York is my guide dog. He's a black lab from Southeastern Guide Dogs.
Well, and I wanted to introduce York, too, because in reading a little bit about you, and the reason why I positioned it that you also happen to be blind is because that's not really what you want to lead with, necessarily. You are a talented woman all in of your own right.
Correct. People make the mistake of thinking disability is an angle, like, oh, she's blind, and that's the story. It's actually not a story. It would be the same as saying, oh, you're blonde, or oh, you have brown hair, and that's not really a story. So as a woman who identifies as disabled, as a woman who is not ashamed of the word blind, it's a part of my life, but it doesn't define me. So it's just like a culture in a way.
And when I read it, you said like it almost seemed like an obstacle for people to get to know you because that was the thing they saw first. And then York actually kind of helped you because who doesn't love a woman with a dog, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And York is very sweet laying on the floor this morning. So let's talk about you have a new book coming out this fall. And I do want to kind of use that as an opportunity for you to share with folks how you got into poetry.
Sure. So my new book is a chapbook. It's a short poetry collection. It's called Neoteny, and it's coming out from Finishing Line Press. I've always written poetry. I love poetry. I've always read a lot of poetry. But the first things I actually published were essays. I also write and publish a lot of essays. And then I finally started sending poetry off to journals, and they accepted it, and I thought they were just being terribly nice to me. You know, oh, isn't that so nice? They took my work. They must have had room. And then I got a lot of encouragement about my poetry, and I read it Jacks by Jacks a couple of years ago, and many people said, your poetry is just beautiful. It's so powerful. They love the dog poems. Everybody loves dog poems. So I got a lot of encouragement. I thought, okay, maybe I can be a poet. That's really what I wanted to do. And so then I just started writing and publishing poetry. And a couple of years ago, I said, this is going to be the year of poetry. I'm going to focus much more on poetry than essays. And that's when I started pulling together the collection, which is about 35 poems.
And I want to ask you, you don't look at your being visually impaired as an obstacle, and you don't even kind of want to be known as a poet first, but having this limitation with your vision actually did, though, you think, from what I read, makes you a better poet. So you've used this kind of as a superpower.
I wouldn't say superpower. There's a little too much daredevil going on in the world. But again, just like a cultural identity, just like your spiritual upbringing or your family upbringing, living with a disability is just another aspect of your life. So yes, there are things that I get to do that you totally sighted people do not get to do.
Or that you notice, or that right. You pick up on, or nuance.
Right. And again, because I'm listening more than looking, I am going to pick up on more sound in the world. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm have some sort of extra power. It's just a matter of where is my brain using those resources. But I do think that it gives me a valid, different perspective. And it's, again, just something that's a part of who I am.
And do you want to, you've got a poem queued up.
Sure.
That I'd love for you to share. And you do have partial vision that I've noticed that you can pick up your iPad and when you put it really close, you can see somewhat.
Yes. And I've got my colors inverted. So it's white letters on a background. Yeah. And that makes it much easier for me to read. So this is a poem I wrote about my great grandmother and it's called Mint. My grandmother's dining room table is covered by rectangular baking sheets lined with plaid kitchen towels. Bunches of mint, still damp from washing, afford the house their fragrance. I open the screen door and stand in the narrow hall, shuffling my feet to smooth the upturned carpet. One hand still gripping the ancient latch, I hail the commonplace, dewy and sharp.
See, what I love about that, I closed my eyes while you read that, and I really envisioned myself in your grandmother's mm-hmm. home. And we've all been in our grandmother's yes. home. And I think sometimes what we see is, oh, I'm in grandma's house, and she's got a bunch of stuff on the table, and it's a little yes. maybe outdated, the furniture and things like that, and the carpet. Who still has shag carpet?
Yeah.
But that's what I meant by your senses and picking up some of those little details that when I close my eyes, I could really envision and picture sure. that and smell the mint mm-hmm. in there.
And I would say that's not necessarily about being a blind poet, but just about being a poet. And I teach my students that poetry is a kind of awareness. You're tuning in to what you could turn around and make into an emotionally significant experience.
Let's talk a little bit about you had a professor who really just saw you as a shining star and mentored you and then afforded you an opportunity to share your talents. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's so important for people who may have a talent to find that person who can help nurture it and build confidence and bring it out. And now you are passing that on. So I'd love to give that professor a little shout out.
Sure. So when I was an undergrad at UNF, I connected with Dr. Chris Gabbard, whose specialty is disability studies. And so Chris and I had a lot of meaningful conversations about what it's like to be a student with a disability because accommodations are not where they should be. And then he would invite me to his classes whenever they would deal with literature about blindness, because, you know, I'm like a handy little expert, I guess. Then I ended up as a TA for Chris, and again, he encouraged me to write and submit my work. And he's one of my many colleagues at UNF that have been very encouraging.
And let's talk about what your future plans are. Do you have any readings coming up? Can anyone sign up for a class of yours? I think, you know, I don't want to say, oh, you're just such an inspiration. Your poetry is beautiful, period.
Thank you.
But I do think that you add the value to show other young people that, you know what, you may have some reason, maybe it's economic, maybe it's physical, maybe it's emotional, maybe it's mental, but when you've got a talent, find someone who'll help you nurture it and then share that with the world.
Yes. So the book will be out in November, and I don't have my spring schedule yet, but we will be planning some readings in the spring, and I have a few more press features coming out as well.
And what advice would you give to others who feel you've got, maybe I've got a little bit of talent, and I'm writing in my room all
sure.
by myself, or I'm writing a song, or I'm painting a picture, and I don't show anybody. Was there a long time that you didn't show anybody?
Yes, absolutely. I have tons of bad poetry that is not even typed up.
I always tell people, you got to be bad before you can be good.
So I would say find your tribe, find the people who encourage you and build you up, but who are also realistic. If you're around people who do nothing but criticize you, then they're not the right people for you. And then keep writing and keep working on it. Don't ever mistake talent as an excuse not to work hard at what you're doing.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us with those inspirational words. We appreciate you and good luck with the book. Up next, A Taste of the Weekend here on First Coast Connect. We'll be right back, everybody.
By watching the walk, the soul learns more. Gathering the courage to explore more of the space beyond the mind, that infinite opening beyond time.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. This season, we're celebrating the 250th birthday of perhaps the most transformative composer in all of music history, Ludwig van Beethoven. We're beginning our Masterworks season with his unique symphony, The Pastoral. Beethoven said, "No one can love the country as I do," and the beautiful Pastoral Symphony provides the proof. Join us October 4th and 5th. Tickets and more at jackssymphony.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the authors of the new book, Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. We talk with Julie Hirschfeld Davis and Michael Shear of the New York Times. They say Trump's goal is to make crossing the border terrifying. They report he even suggested a border moat filled with snakes and alligators. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. More than 2 years after Hurricane Irma struck the Florida Keys, one woman is just trying to get the state to buy her home and knock it down so she can stop living in it.
It's not safe, it's not secure, and it is definitely not sanitary, but it's all that I've got.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Impeachment might stand in the way of President Trump's re-election, but so might other Republicans who are challenging him in 2020. Former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford has said he will support Trump if he wins the nomination, but Sanford is also running to be the GOP's choice. He'll answer your questions next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back, everyone. The Pontevedra Education Fund for the Arts is throwing a fall fiesta for the arts. Its inaugural fundraising event at the Pontevedra Concert Hall this evening. And Heather Predileto, board member, Pontevedra Education Foundation for the Arts, is here with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Charlene.
This is exciting, your first ever event. So everybody's been up all night, working hard right now. I see you have a silent auction.
Yes.
Baskets are being wrapped as we speak.
Yes, and we actually doubled our attendance, Our goal was for 75, and we have 150
wow.
attending. And this is, like you said, our inaugural fundraiser. The organization has been around since 1983, and historically all the donations have come from private donations. And not only is tonight about raising money, but we also want to raise awareness in the community for all that the organization does.
So let's talk about the organization, the Pontevedra Education Foundation for the Arts.
Yes. So our mission is to enhance the learning experience through art enrichment and educational programs that encourage creative thinking and self-expression. Studies show that students do better in math and writing and speech when they're exposed to the arts. And all of the donations that we receive this evening and also throughout the year will go towards funding the efforts of the foundation in all the schools in Pontevedra. When the foundation started, there was only one, and now there's seven. So the community has definitely grown, and there's a lot more to support. But I could talk all day about the different efforts that we have, but I'll focus on a few. And
sure.
One is probably the one that's most of the public is aware of in the community, and that's our annual art show. It's called Artworks, and we have it every spring. And that's where art teachers from each school select a work of art from each classroom, and that work of art is displayed in a gallery-like setting at a venue and judged by professional judges. And last year we had 150 families that were in attendance, and it was our 35th annual art show. So every year it's a big hit. Another effort that we have is funding art reproductions of famous and important artworks that hang in all the schools. Our goal is to have 100 hanging by the end of the year in each school. So we're headed that way.
Well, I love that you have tangible goals that really yep. say, you know what, we can say we've done this and we've accomplished this. And I do want to talk about a little bit about the fundraiser tonight, because it's tonight. So yep. and you've just doubled your attendance. Is there any more room for tickets?
Well, if you go on our website and try, you can try to purchase more. I haven't looked in the past few minutes, so I'm not sure if they're still available. But the website is www.pvedfoundation.com, and hopefully you'll be able to purchase.
So I mentioned silent auction. What else do you have coming up tonight?
Well, we have bands from the local middle and high school, jazz bands.
Oh, wonderful.
So, yes, we've got, I think, three different bands that will be performing. And we'll have speakers. one of the principals will be speaking and just talking about all the work that the foundation has done.
And great food.
We're going to have Taco Lou. So yes, excellent food. Taco Lou is catering. A wonderful silent auction. Lots of options for people.
And any big sponsor you need to give a shout out to? My background's PR marketing. So is there anybody you got to give a shout out
we've
to?
We've got Watson out at the beaches. And my mind is going blank. I'm so sorry.
And all the wonderful sponsors who have done so much to support us throughout the year.
All right. The PGA Tour is definitely a big sponsor.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And the best of luck in your inaugural event. I'm sure it's going to be great. You can't go wrong at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall tonight.
Thank you.
At 6:30. All right, finally this hour, Damian Lamar, the host of WJCT's Taste Test Radio, is here with a taste of the weekend. So good to see you.
Good to see you too, Charlene.
And I love we're talking about the weekend already.
Yes, it's here. It's Friday Eve, and I'm happy to be here. First and foremost, really, really excited about what's happening tonight. Tonight at the Nonprofit Center of Northeast Florida at 6 p.m., at the Jesse DuPont Center, there's going to be a free jam session with PB&J. PB&J stands for Party Benefit and Jam. And it invites participants in the local community to come out and learn about organizations, their working areas, and it's fast presentations where the speaker gets 20 slides and 20 seconds for each slide. So really, really super, super fast.
It's like speed dating for nonprofits.
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's really awesome. Really, really cool. So come out.
Is this to see if you want to get involved and support these organizations?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
This tonight's topic is how do you feel about Jacksonville, whether you consider the city's history and are you contemplating the city's future?
Oh, great topic.
So, yeah,
hello.
Four amazing speakers going to be speaking tonight. And
I love it.
That's the first pick of the weekend. Also, one of my other picks is Brew. And new company presents Breach, a solo show by Maya Elaine. She's going to be featuring a new body of work, presenting her first solo show. And there'll be an in-depth discussion or series of work exploring a journey through change and inner emotion. And that's going to be at Brew in Five Points at 1024 Park Street. And guess what else?
What else?
AIGA's Jacksonville is the biggest event of the year, their design and music festival showcase. They're going to be having the Power of Design, which is AIGA's influence shaping the music industry. Whether you're a designer, artist, you got to go check that out. Really, really excited about that. That's Saturday night, October 5th from 5 to 10. And last but certainly not least, we're giving away tickets to the Beaches Oktoberfest.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, everybody. I'm Charlene Shirk filling in for Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Have a wonderful day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.